Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Jill Robbins, Pete Musto, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Almost every week, John Little sees images of Native Americans being represented as relics of the past. There is the picture of a young Native woman on a container of butter. There are the children's teepees sold at popular stores. And there are the sports fans. People who support teams with Native American-connected names often paint their faces and do the tomahawk chop. The movement was meant to look like a Native American using a sharp tool called a tomahawk. Little lives in the southwestern state of Arizona and is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. He notes that many Americans have been discussing a lot about racist imagery in recent months, especially about the history and meaning of blackface. But such discussions have not included the outdated and often offensive representations of Native Americans. These are everyday realities for Native people, Little said.
Experts say that red face, the practice of dressing or acting like a Native American, gets less attention than blackface for a few reasons. European Americans have deep-rooted but mistaken ideas about American history. Also, Native Americans make up less than 2% of the United States population. African Americans, by comparison, make up about 13%. Native Americans have tried for years to make people understand that stereotyping Native Americans as violent, uninformed, and humorless is deeply offensive. They have not seen much change, however. Throughout America's history, people have put on red face, worn feathers, and spoken in broken English as they played Native Americans in theater, film, and everyday life. In one of the earliest examples, colonists who were dressed as Mohawk Indians poured tea into the Boston Harbor in 1773 in protest of British rule. Philip J. DeLoria is a Harvard University history professor and writer of Playing Indian. He said, most people think that those old images, largely based on 19th century Plains Indians, represent who Native Americans were and still are. Some even believe Natives no longer exist in the country.
The most common place to see red face is at sporting events for teams like the Washington Redskins, the Atlanta Braves, and the Cleveland Indians. There have been protests against the Redskins' name for 50 years, but the team's name has not changed. But some news organizations have refused to publish the name of the football team in America's capital. In 2017, John Little made a documentary film about the team and its chosen name. It is called More Than a Word. In it, fans explain that they think the team name honors Native Americans. These fans paint their faces, perform their versions of a Native American dance or war cry, and wear fake headdresses. Although changes have been slow, there have been some positive signs. The Cleveland Indians sports team, for example, has new clothing for players that does not include the image of Chief Wahoo, a Native American face shown in bright red and wearing one feather. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
You never know what you will find in a pawn shop, stores which sell used goods. Where else can you find snow removal equipment sitting next to a costly piece of clothing? Or a beautifully designed timekeeping instrument from 19th century France next to a laptop computer? Top Dollar Pawn is a pawn shop in Waldorf, Maryland. On a recent day, the store's manager met with a man who wanted to sell gold caps from the teeth of his grandfather, who had died. Some people might be shocked by the man's proposal, but store manager Stuffy Carroll was not. He explained that Top Dollar Pawn would only buy the gold after it had been removed from the teeth. "This happens all the time," Carroll told VOA. Top Dollar owner Michael Cohen has two pawn shops in Maryland, both close to Washington, D.C. He buys and sells anything of value, which includes costly jewelry, musical instruments, and power tools. His biggest seller is jewelry, he said, as he showed a collection of diamond rings and gold necklaces. Sales of used objects bring in money, but pawn shops make most of their profit through loans to people in exchange for something of value. There is interest on the loan that is higher than a bank rate. If the money is repaid within 30 days, then the owner gets their item back. But in other cases, the store keeps it for resale. The average loan is $150. For people without credit or financing, pawn shops can help them get the money they need. About 85% of borrowers pay back their pawn shop loans. Top Dollar manager Mike Thoman said a lot of people who visit his store talk to him about their problems, and he supports them when they're down on their luck. In a lot of cases, people don't have any other outlet to get the money they need to get through the week, to put gas in the car, or pay the electric bill, he said. In the past, many Americans thought of pawn shops as seedy places, often connected to dark or disreputable activities. But today, the mostly independently owned stores are more brightly lit and welcoming. Eric Reiser, owner of three stores in Virginia called Royal Pawn, says pawn shops are now more popular with the general public. "We have tons of different stuff, like artwork, antiques, and sports memorabilia," he added. "Customer service is a huge part of our business, and hopefully that keeps people wanting to come back to us," said Michael Cohen. Experts estimate about 30 million people visit the nearly 11,000 pawn shops in the United States every year. Some of those customers find hidden treasures. Eric Reiser said his store once held a piece of art from painter Pablo Picasso. "We actually had a bird head that I sold to a man for $500, he added. Later, Reiser discovered that kind of bird was last alive more than 100 years ago, and the head was valued at $20,000. He also noted that used guitars are finding a new market in pawn shops. Cohen said his business has suffered because of sales of used items on the internet. He recognizes that more pawn shops may have to start selling products through the internet, yet he thinks the physical stores are here to stay. I'm Pete Musto.
A new examination of temperatures in the United States shows that there were two times more heat records set in the past 20 years than cold ones. The Associated Press analyzed temperature information collected by 424 weather stations across the country. The analysis included temperature information from 1920 to 2008. It found that most decades during the 20th century had close to an even ratio of hot to cold records. But since 1999, 87% of the weather stations had more hot records than cold. And 42 stations reported having at least 5 hot records for every cold one since 1999. At 11 stations, the hot to cold ratio during the period was 10 to 1 or greater. One place with the greatest difference in hot and cold records was the Southern California city of Pasadena. It went 19 years between cold records, the analysis found. It set a low temperature record last month for the first time since June 5, 1999. Between those two record cold days, Pasadena set 145 hot records. That included the city's all-time heat record of 45 degrees Celsius set last year. The AP says it has shared its analysis with experienced climate and data scientists. Several experts say results of the examination support earlier scientific research. And the information provides further evidence that human-caused climate change has led to higher temperatures over the years, the experts said. The use of such data is very important to identifying the long-term effects of climate change, climate scientist Deke Arndt told the Associated Press. He is the head of climate observation for the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Arndt noted, for example, that the first 2 months of 2019 showed twice as many cold records than hot ones, the exact opposite of the results in AP's analysis. However, he said such short-term differences are not as valuable as true climate trends measured over many years. Arndt said the AP analysis shows the United States has been in a steady period of major warming for a long time. He added that this trend is expected to continue to explore and break the warm end of the spectrum much more than the cold end. Former Weather Channel expert Guy Walton also gave his thoughts on the findings. Walton, who has been studying hot and cold extreme records since 2000, told the AP he thinks the results show an unmistakable trend. You are getting more extremes. Your chances for getting more dangerous extremes are going up with time, he said. Arndt noted that such temperature extremes could have many different effects on people's lives. These include financial effects, such as increased hospital stays, higher energy usage, and farm losses. A recent study involving 22 U.S. states found that each summer, about 36,000 people seek hospital treatment because of extreme heat. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In our last program, we told you how the flow of immigration to the United States began to change in the 1880s. Before then, most of the immigrants came from Central and Northern Europe, from Britain, Ireland, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries. The largest number came from Britain. They found it easy to settle in a country that, until 1776, was a collection of British colonies. The newcomers from Britain shared the same language with the Americans and many of the same traditions. Some of these early immigrants were skilled workers who found good jobs in American industry. Others were farmers who came to America for free land. Robert Bostick and Jack Weitzel continue the story of immigration in the United States.
After 1880, the flood of immigration from Northern and Central Europe began to fall. Now, most immigrants were coming from Eastern and Southern Europe, from Russia, Poland, Romania, Italy, Greece. These new immigrants were different from those who came earlier. Most did not speak English. Most were poor farmers who had few special skills. Most had little or no education. They were, however, good workers. They did not protest working long hours for low pay. They did not demand better working conditions. They usually refused to join labor unions or take part in strikes.
American factory owners were pleased with the new immigrants. They gave them jobs formerly held by higher-paid American workers. The owners asked the new workers to write letters to friends still in the old country, urging them to come to America. And they came by the hundreds of thousands to take jobs in steel factories in Pennsylvania and the coal mines of West Virginia. They worked in the lumber camps of Michigan and in the stockyards and the meatpacking plants of Chicago. American workers then began to protest as their jobs were filled by immigrants who were happy to work for less money.
The protests were especially bitter on the Pacific coast, where thousands of Chinese immigrants were settling in California. The Chinese arrived there after 1850 to help build Western railroads. After the railroads were completed, these Chinese newcomers turned to other jobs. More came every year. By the 1870s, California's political leaders were demanding an end to further immigration from China. In 1882, Congress passed a law that barred Chinese immigration for 10 years. The law was extended for another 10 years, then made permanent.
The immigration law of 1882 put other limits on immigration. It closed the country to criminals, the mentally ill, and persons who could not support themselves. Later, others were added to this list: persons with diseases, anarchists, alcoholics. This, however, did not greatly reduce immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, and opponents of immigration demanded stronger action. Some proposed a literacy test. Immigrants would have to show that they could read and write. An immigrant who could not would not be permitted to enter the country.
Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts urged Congress to pass such a law. In a Senate speech, Lodge said, "If we care for the welfare, the wages, or the standard of life of American working men, we should take immediate steps to limit foreign immigration. There is no danger to our working men from the coming of skilled workers or of trained and educated men. But there is a serious danger from the flood of unskilled, ignorant foreign labor. This labor not only takes lower wages, but accepts a standard of living so low that the American working man cannot compete with it." Senator Lodge continued, "A literacy test will bear very lightly, if at all, upon English-speaking immigrants or Germans, Scandinavians, and French. The races which would suffer most under a literacy test would be those with which the English-speaking people have never united, and who are most different from the great majority of the people of the United States." Congress passed the proposal. President Cleveland, however, vetoed it. He said the nation had nothing to fear from immigrants who could not read or write. He said there was greater danger from some of the educated immigrants who urged violence and anarchy. It took a number of years before Congress was able to pass a law demanding a literacy test for immigrants.
Another problem troubled President Cleveland: high tariffs, taxes on imports. Soon after his election, Cleveland decided to learn what he could about the tariff. "I'm sorry to say," said Cleveland, "but the truth is, I know nothing about the tariff." Cleveland studied all the information he could find about the tariff. He found that the tariff was used not only to get money for the government, but to protect American industry from foreign competition. The tariffs had been raised so high that they were producing more money than the government needed. Cleveland decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get them reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of businessmen. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. He said, "What is the use of being elected or re-elected if you don't stand for something?"
So, late in 1887, Cleveland sent a tariff message to Congress. He said it was wrong to raise more tax money than the government needed. "When this happens," he said, "money is withdrawn from the people's use and kept in the public treasury where it does no good. It threatens the economy and invites dishonest attempts to use the money for private interests. The government," he said, "received most of this unnecessary tax money from tariffs." He said the present tariff laws were vicious, unfair, and illogical. He said they raised the prices of all imported goods which could be taxed. They also led American manufacturers to raise their prices as high as those charged for imported goods. Cleveland said some men had become rich because protective tariffs let them charge high prices. He noted that American businessmen liked to talk about the strength and success of American industry. But he said that when the question of the tariff is raised, businessmen claim that industry is weak. They say they cannot compete with low-priced foreign products.
Cleveland said he did not propose that all tariffs be ended. He said some were needed to raise money for the government. And he said some industries could not exist unless they were protected by tariffs. But he said tariffs should not let some industries make huge profits. Cleveland warned that it would be far better to make safe, careful, and intelligent changes in the tariff laws now. Otherwise, he said, there might come a time when an angry public would demand radical and sweeping changes.
The House of Representatives moved quickly to pass a moderate bill that would reduce many of the tariffs. The legislation, called the Mills Bill, was exactly what Cleveland wanted. But the bill ran into trouble in the Senate, where Republicans had control. Senator William Allison, a Republican from Iowa, proposed a different tariff bill. It was one that would increase tariffs, not reduce them. The Senate debated the tariff question for months, and since it was 1888, a presidential election year, the tariff became an important election issue. The Democrats promised low tariffs that would mean lower prices for the people. The Republicans defended high tariffs, which they said were necessary to protect American industry and labor. The Democrats nominated Grover Cleveland for another 4-year term. The Republicans held their nominating convention 2 weeks later.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.